This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2016, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 5.
I'm going to call your attention to the next phrase today, marvelous are thy works. And in emailing Howard about this session, I chose not to call it amazing or awesome, Adam, because those words tend to get used today aplenty. I want you to marvel in the creation of God today. Just marvel in the majesty of God. When I was in college, one of the moments I will never forget is holding a human skull and just looking at this hunk of bone and saying, this held a living person's brain. That is awesome. That is astounding. It is marvelous to look at this. So we have a couple of things I'd like to point you to today, simply to help you marvel in the majesty of God. Astounding Adam, the wonders of the human body. Now, unfortunately, my children couldn't be here this week. But if you get a chance, and there's a couple of fairly young babies around here this week, pick those up and hold them. From the moment of conception, they have a beating heart within something like 18 days. 18 days from one cell to a functioning circulatory system. That is astounding. Look at their fingers. Now, the youngest I've found here this week, something like 8 months old. Look at that fat little 8-month-old finger. The microvasculature of that finger requires that red blood cells go through their single file. That's on a scale I don't know how to comprehend, and I'm going to introduce you to things here today even finer than that. I'd like to look first at something our body secretes. Now, we make something in the order of 25 different fluids in our body, and I briefly considered just spending 2 minutes on each of them and quickly gave that up. I want to talk about saliva to start with. Now, most of you just ate lunch, which involved you producing a good bit of this, so I want you to know what happened. First of all, what does your saliva contain? Well, it's mostly water. It has some electrolytes, things like sodium, potassium, calcium, magnesium, chloride, phosphate, and, get this, bicarb. We'll come back to bicarbonate later. It has some mucus in it. That's why if you knew when you came to hear a nurse talk, it might get a little bit edgy, right? Okay. If you spit in a cup and let it sit, it eventually sort of thickens up and starts to stink. Well, mucus is responsible for the thickening. There's some epidermal growth factor in it, so when you lick your wounds, it's not a bad idea. There's various enzymes, such as alpha amylase. Alpha amylase is responsible for breaking down starch. Now, back in school, I was told if you chew a cracker long enough, eventually it tastes sweet, and I never got to that point. I don't know if I didn't have the patience or what. There's lipase. Lipase is an interesting enzyme. Lipase doesn't start to work optimally until you have a pH of around 4. That's pretty acidic. So lipase, anytime in biology you hear an ACE, that's an enzyme pretty much. Lipe is fat. It breaks down fat. But it doesn't work until it has an optimum pH of about 4. So that doesn't start to work until it gets in your gut and gets acidic enough. And then there's lysosome, which kills bacterial matter. So those are three fairly important enzymes in your saliva. And then there are cells. Cells, you say? What kind of cells? Get this. 8 million human cells, cheek cells, tongue cells, you shed them all the time, but then something like 500 million bacteria. Now, if you want something astounding, as you sit before me right now, okay, Matt, we're going to pick on you. What the rest of us see as Matt Peachy by cell number is 1/10 human. Ballpark, by number of cells, he's 90% bacterial, fungal, etc. There's thousands of species of bacteria that live on your skin. There's something like 6,000 species in your guts. We'll get to those. But by cell number, not by cell size or cell weight. But if you're simply going to count human cells versus other, non-human, he's only 10% human. Furthermore, we make the saliva all the time. Now, we have two very different kinds of saliva, unstimulated and stimulated. Unstimulated is what you're making all the time. Okay? Now, these rates are wildly varying. Right now, it seems like I'm making less than I should be. I'm feeling a little dry. It's something around 0.25 mL a minute. But they've found people that make significantly more and significantly less, but they don't complain of dry mouth. To get someone to complain of dry mouth, they have to be making way less, like, you know, a third or a quarter of normal. I had a nursing instructor that one of her lines was, normal is a setting on the dryer. Any of this stuff, you know, we can say, well, this is normal, but it might not be normal for you. So normal is just a setting on the dryer. Then there's stimulated saliva, which you just got done making a whole bunch of. We make that at a rate of something like 2 mL per minute. Now, when you smell mom's fill in your favorite meal here, you know, chicken pot pie, you say, oh, my mouth is watering. By any way, we can measure saliva flow, and if you want to look this up, it's called a Lashley cup. That's one of the measures. Anyway, we can measure saliva flow. It does not increase when you smell a good ham or apple pie or et cetera. What we think is our mouth watering is something else, or our brain tricking us, or we're simply more in tune to it, or something. But anyway, we can measure saliva production does not extraordinarily increase just off of smell. It does chewing, and it doesn't matter what you chew. You can chew a cotton wad, and the old parotid glands will crank it up. They'll start dropping saliva, and you're chewing cotton. Now, okay, at 2 mL a minute stimulated and 0.25 mL or 1/3 mL a minute unstimulated, this comes to 1 liter a day. That's more than this thing, a day. What's that in a lifetime? 7,000 gallons. That is the size of an average school principal's backyard pool. See, Linford and Gerald and some of these guys have been throwing darts at me all week. This is my chance to ask Gerald if the pool in his backyard looks like something like that. 7,000 gallons of saliva in your lifetime. Well, what does this do for us? There's several main functions. Number one, and these are in no particular order, lubrication. It lubricates both our speech and our swallowing. Now, I never thought about this in a very personal way until this winter I was diagnosed with severe sleep apnea. I now sleep with a mask over my face and hooked up to a CPAP machine at night to keep my brain to telling me I need to breathe. Well, I started out with just a nose mask, so you still sort of look like an elephant with this thing over your nose and a trunk going off to this thing. But apparently, I don't shut my mouth when I sleep any more than when I'm not sleeping. And so it was ineffective. And what happens when you blow a significant volume of air through your nose and your mouth is open, your mouth gets really dry. Now, I'm not a heavy drinker. I've never woken up with a hangover and the cotton mouth of a hangover, I have no idea. But I've woken up after a couple hours of that, and literally I had to consciously peel my tongue off the side of my mouth. It was the driest mouth you could possibly fathom, times about 3. It was unbelievable because I had dried it out. I never appreciated the lubrication quality of saliva until those moments. The second thing it lubricates us for is swallowing. I suspect most of you just swallowed your lunch. What do you have for lunch, Chester? Okay, a wrap. Did you make pretzels?
Yes, I did.
Imagine eating those pretzels up here. Amazing, by the way. Think about eating those pretzels with no saliva. So what you have to imagine is you're going to put them in a mortar and pestle and grind them up, because that's what your teeth would be doing without saliva. Now swallow that. As we chew, our teeth and our tongue are chewing and breaking down these foods physically. And our tongue helps form this food into a ball or wad called a bolus. So to add to your words this week, plethora, now you have bolus. Our tongue then launches that bolus to the back of our mouth, and this whole cascade of swallowing takes place. Now we'll discuss some of that later. But have you ever seen what it looks like to swallow? Today is your lucky day. This is a video shot from the side. The food has been a radioactive tracer put on the food, so you can see what he's chewing. You can't see the chewing so well, but you'll suddenly see this chunk down the throat as he swallows. Chewing, 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 chewing. Watch carefully, I'll launch it up to the back of his mouth. There it went, and down, first swallow. He'll go again, second swallow. And clear, his third swallow. Now we'll take a drink. Notice he's holding the liquid in his mouth, swallowed. And then, a second swallow to clear. There we go. That's what happens when you swallow. Now imagine doing that without saliva. You have potato chips, bread, a good moist spice cake. You know, your tongue could mash it up in this little ball of a pellet, but there's no way you're going to effectively swallow. It's just going to stick. That's the lubrication of saliva. Second function is taste. Without saliva, you can't taste. So get your tongue good and dry, however you choose to do that, and put something in your you can't taste it. You can only taste molecules that are soluble in saliva. Pick up a nice marble, put it in your mouth, and tell me how glass tastes. It doesn't. There's nothing there for your saliva to dissolve, because your taste buds are down in pits on your tongue. So for you to taste, that saliva has to dissolve whatever it is you're chewing on and bring those molecules down into those pits for you to taste. So without saliva, you can't taste. Number three is digestion. I told you we have enzymes that help us digest. And it looks like that would be experiment equipment. No science experiment is complete without bubbling beakers. So I had to throw that one on there. Styrofoam bowl, butterscotch pudding, clean spoon, butterscotch pudding now laced with amylase and lipase. Oh, you wanted to see what happens. Remind me to come back. So we'll let digestion work a while. Final function is protection. Protection from what? Those mucins I told you about, that they're mucousy, they help make a physical barrier that make bacteria colonies difficult to form and grow. And if you're a bacteria, that's kind of your job in life, is to grow and reproduce. It helps control that. Second of all, that bicarb I talked to you about in the electrolytes helps neutralize the acid. Some of us are of the tribe that we like to drink some acid at breakfast time. Coffee's very acidic. Well, and then there are people who make these health drinks that are very, very acidic. What happens to that acid? Well, your bicarb in your saliva helps neutralize that. Third thing is it washes your mouth. So there are, if you think about it, little bits of food stuck between your teeth right now. Unless, of course, you brushed your teeth after lunch, which my class will work on that in a few minutes, okay? Your saliva flow is helping, A, physically wash those bits of teeth out of the cracks, those bits of food out of the cracks between your teeth. B, helping dissolve what's there. That's why if you get a popcorn hull stuck down in there, in your gums, because we eat popcorn at night, tomorrow morning it'll come out easier because that hull has been softened. And it helps, your saliva helps loosen that thing up. Saliva. And some of your students just thought it was for spit wads. Have you marveled in the creation of God in saliva? See, God could have made us a thousand different other ways, but he didn't. And your evolutionist friends will say, what a lucky break. We just happen to be of the tribe that evolved parotid glands. Lucky us. Marvel in the creation of God in your saliva and parotid glands. So that was something we secrete. Now I'd like to look at absorption. I'm going to need a little help here. Matt, I'm going to need you just to hold this, okay? You pull on this tail, and no one knows exactly how long this is. You just pull on that and hand it over your left shoulder, okay? But your job is to make sure the end doesn't disappear back into the crowd.
Okay.
Okay, you just pull on it, hand it over your shoulder. Hey, come on, you won't tear anything. I mean, hand it over your shoulder and just keep passing it back. Those of you that have it in your hands, hold it up high. I mean, there's 400 people here that want to see this thing. My wife took great pains to make it. Don't let her effort go to vain. Oh, yeah, there you have it. Matt, you had one job. That is an approximate replica of your small intestine. 1.25 inches in diameter, somewhere between 20 and 30 feet long. Interesting fact, women, yours are slightly longer. Interesting fact number two, when you die, they get even longer. All of you, when you die, your small intestine grows. Why? Come on, biology majors, why would that happen? It's wrapped in smooth muscle. What happens to our muscles when we die? They relax, and by definition, slightly expand. Okay, you don't have to hold it up. One of you that has your hand on it can claim this as yours. Okay?
Aha!
Okay, so the end, okay, so give us just a second here. Matt, hold up your end once. So this thing, the intestine is 20 to 30 feet long. This is the small intestine. So we'll think of it looped up like a nice paper clip here. Matt's end here in the light denim is the duodenum. This is right off your stomach. Okay, you can let that down. Every day, somewhere between 1 and 3 gallons of chyme, which is the slop that comes out the bottom of your end of your stomach, is released into the small intestine in total. The duodenum's about 1 foot long. It adds more bicarb, which you remember neutralizes acid, and continues the digestion process. The next section, the middle section in dark denim, is the jejunum. This is where sugar, fatty acids, and amino acids are absorbed. The jejunum's something in the ballpark of 11 feet long. Finally, back there somewhere in the light section is the ileum. That's where we absorb vitamin B12 and bile, as well as anything else. Now, the ileum, I mean, all these numbers are approximates. And so the ileum was supposed to be 13 feet long. And as my wife and I were making it and stuffing it with pillow stuffing, and turning it right side out, which took more effort than I expected. I had the thing looped up. I said, wait a second. Something's wrong, because 13 feet and 12 feet, this should be about in the middle. Through a mistake in production, the ileum here, I think, is more in the line of 16 feet long, but that's life. The other thing, my 3-year-old wanted me to make sure I brought this home, because that is her skip rope. She doesn't know how to jump rope. She's just read in her Francis books that Francis jumps rope, so this must be the tool. I said, no, somebody else is going to use this. Papa will buy you a skip rope when you need one, okay? But one of you can have that. So that's the parts of our small intestine, and we tend to think of it as this neatly coiled, yeah, it's 28 feet long.
I'm just surprised they give it that easily.
Well, they're polite. We think of it as neatly coiled up in our abdominal cavity, but is it? And furthermore, at 1.25 inches ballpark in diameter, and this one's 28 feet long, it has an absorptive area of 2,700 square feet. That's over half of a basketball court. How do you get half of a basketball court in that thing? That's crazy. Well, okay, so it's not coiled up neatly like a paperclip. It's ziggy and zaggy all over the place. Will that help us? Will that help us if the thing's, you know, all jumbled up like that? Well, you physics people and mechanical engineers, when you make a corner out of something, you actually lose area. You don't gain area. How does that work? Well, it works because the inside of this, the lumen, the inside wall of the small intestine has these circular folds called plicae circularis. It's got all these ridges and folds that greatly increase its surface area. But half a basketball court? A little more than? Well, if we zoom in on those plicae circularis, on those ridges in the wall, coming off of those ridges are all these fingers we call villi. Well, you're starting to stack up surface area now. You people that paint and hang wallpaper, you know, you can have a room 12 by 12, but you start, you know, jut ins and jut outs, and you rapidly add wall area to paint or paper or whatever have you. Well, if we zoom in on these villi, we find microvilli. Each of those cells has many hair-like projections sticking out. What if we zoom in on those? Any guesses? Electron microscope, this is what the inside of your intestine looks like. Do you see some absorptive area? Think about this with me for a second. Take half a basketball court. Now, this gym is much bigger than the standard basketball court. In this gym, it would be about a third of this gym. If my calculations and my emailed figures from Katrina, every year I come, I'm emailing Katrina about something random about the dimensions of this gym, and she's like, you're awfully fascinated with our gym. But think about it. How do you absorb all those nutrients? Think of what you ate for lunch and spread it in an even skim over a third of this gym. Well, absolutely, you have plenty of area to absorb all that. Marvel in the creation of our God. Marvel in the design of our God. That's how you get half a basketball court wrapped up inside your stomach. Thirdly, today, I'd like to finish with feeling. Now, here's a picture of a fingertip. How small do you think you can feel with your fingertip? How fine, how small of an object would you guess you could feel? Any guesses today? Anybody? Josh is chewing on it. There's two ways we measure this. One is called static touch, and that is I just lay my finger down and try to feel something. In static touch, it's not that impressive. Then there's dynamic touch. Drag your finger across the surface. And through people with ways and means beyond I, they made smoother and smoother and smoother and smoother surfaces till they were using electrostatic something or other to make little ridges and waves in these things until they found kind of the edge of human feeling. At 13 nanometers. Well, what's a nanometer? I don't use that term. I mean, the smallest I go is micrometer, or microgram, generally. What's a nanometer? We're talking 13 billionths of a meter. Take a millimeter, we've all got that. Chop that into a million pieces. Astounding. Astounding the degree. And to give you some perspective, this is way beyond human cell. This is way past red blood cell, a lot smaller than a sperm cell, a lot smaller than a bacteria. This is an eighth of a virus particle. This is about the size of an antibody. Because I've been vaccinated against hepatitis B, I have those antibodies in my blood. Much smaller than the actual virus particle, the antibodies, the code that tells my body how to fight that particular disease. That's the range we're talking. That's 10 to 13 nanometers. Your fingernails grow at the rate of a nanometer per second. So feel your fingernail. A second later, feel it. The difference is what you can feel. Okay. Put a different way. Here is a picture you should be familiar with. It's on the binder you're holding. If your finger was the size of this gym, if your fingertip laid on the roof here and just fit nicely in this gym, you could tell whether or not Jonas Sauter has hair. Or Lyle Musser. You could feel the individual sheet of paper he was holding. You could feel the thickness of one paper if your finger were magnified to the size of this gym. Put another way, if your finger was the size of the earth, you could tell the difference between your house and your car. How astounding the creative power of God. That's what we can feel. What happens if we feel too much? This is the unit I work in, Domitilla 3D, St. Mary's Hospital, Rochester, Minnesota. Brand new renovated unit. It has not looked that shiny or clean or empty since. I spend a fair portion of my day concerned about my patient's pain. Now, pain is described or defined as physical suffering or discomfort caused by illness or injury. And pain costs. How much? Well, if you're a patient of mine and I give you 2 extra strength Tylenol, 1,000 milligrams of Tylenol, that is going to cost you a nickel. If I give you a dose of IV fentanyl, even though it's only 100 micrograms, it's 1/10,000th of the amount of drug, that particular dose is going to cost you somewhere in the order of $100. Key, it's a much stronger drug. 100 mics of fentanyl would be more than enough to relieve any discomfort any of you are feeling sitting here. The worst pain of my life was a gallbladder attack, and 100 mics of fentanyl made me feel pretty happy. Public health burden of pain is something on the order of $600 billion a year. That's what we spend, and I'm assuming, I don't know for sure, but I'm assuming this figures into lost productivity and things like that, that is not simply out-of-pocket spending on pain a year. What's $600 billion a year? I mean, we went from nanometers to $600 billion. We quickly lose scope here. Well, $600 billion a year comes to $19,000 a second. Instead of working 9 months for that, school teachers, 1 second. Or put another way, Christian Aid Ministries has assets, according to their most recent financials I could find, in the order of $50 million. 53, 54, something, round numbers, $50 million is what CAM, that's their total assets. At $19,000 a second, we could have more than bought CAM completely off since we started singing here at 1:30. That's what we spend on pain. Astounding. Astounding. And I said I spend a great deal of my time talking about pain with my patients because our government has mandated we shall do that, and they base part of our reimbursement as a hospital off of your perception of how well I controlled your pain, which is kind of like letting McDonald's popularity dictate nutrition guidelines. There's what I want, and then there's what's good for me. And the two are not necessarily correlated. But that's the system we're in. And so we use this 0 to 10 pain scale. From 0 to 10, how would you rate your pain right now? And often I have to explain, now 0 is nothing, and 10 is the worst thing you can imagine in your life. And I use various analogies, one of which is it's like being fed through a wood chipper, which is graphic, and it sort of hits you viscerally, but that actually wouldn't hurt that bad. I also tell people it's like being run over by a truck while being set on fire, or if you were to be set on fire and we would choose to put it out with a sledgehammer. Okay, that's a 10 pain. The worst thing you can possibly imagine. Just a tip. When your nurse or doctor asks you 0 to 10 and you say 15, you will lose credibility. Okay, you just will. Particularly the longer you hold on to that. This is the worst pain I felt recently. A patient bit me. She bit and hung on for about 30 seconds. I told him in the ER, I said, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds, a minute, I don't know, the clock stood still. And later on somebody said, oh, it was a good 20 or 30 seconds. She bit and hung on for weeks. I could still feel it. You can still feel the bump in my muscle in my arm. Incredible pain. I mean, one tiny little bit of blood there, but an impressive set of teeth marks. And an impressive story to tell.
What were you doing?
She had dementia. She was not in possession of her faculties. We were simply trying to keep her corralled to the unit so she wouldn't go down a stairs off to another unit. We had called in our emergency team to help deal with the situation. But so I was on the receiving end of that pain. Sometimes I'm on the giving end of the pain. I give people that are out of control, I give them shots in their arm that they don't want. I, multiple times a day, check people's blood sugar. You know, I prick their finger, check blood sugar, and how much insulin to give them. I make them walk when they hurt. But on the other hand, I also relieve pain by things like a hot water pack, ice pack, meds, reposition, all these sort of things. We spend a fair bit of time talking about pain. How many of you would like to be pain-free? Stand up. If you want to be pain-free, stand up. You can be seated. If you look carefully, you'll notice the butterscotch pudding is now in an even puddle where it was have ridges and things. It is now an even puddle as the amylase in my saliva, and you can't see it that well. You can come up and look at it. The amylase in my saliva has broken down the starch in that pudding. Starch, i.e. cornstarch, is what makes pudding or custard thick, so it gives it that structure. And the amylase in your saliva breaks down that starch. Okay. Back to pain. If you said you'd like to be pain-free, I'd like you to meet two people, Ashlyn Blocker and Stephen Pete. Ashlyn, this picture is a couple years old. I don't know how old the picture of Stephen is. Ashlyn, I believe, is about 16 now. Both of these people have a genetic mutation called SCN9A that they feel no pain. Ever. Never have. They have never felt pain. They are incapable of feeling pain. Now, those parents in the room, cogitate for me a second what would happen if your child never felt pain. Somewhere in school, I remember reading a story about a guy who had this problem, and they actually worked with him because the effects are similar to leprosy. Through self-harm, you eventually just destroy yourself. Because pain tells us there's a problem. Through self-harm, you eventually start to destroy things. When Ashlyn was 2, she put her hand on a hot muffler of a gasoline pressure washer. Burned her hand. Both of these people, when they were teething, their parents would find blood in the bed in the morning, literally chewed hunks off of their tongue, bit holes in their lips, teething. Well, any teething child, they gnaw and chew on everything, but that pain sort of tells them to stop chewing on their tongue. These didn't have that option. Stephen has had something around 70 surgeries for broken bones by the time he was 30. At the time of the interview that I got most of this from. At the time of that interview, the doctor said the next time you hurt your knee, it's going to be amputation. There is simply nothing more I can do to rebuild these torn ligaments and tendons and everything. There's nothing more I can do to fix your knee. The next time, we're simply going to have to amputate. There's nothing wrong with his knee. He can't feel pain, and so over time, he's literally destroyed his joints. Fingers. Ashlyn, they said at the time of this interview, they said she had basically, you know, figured this out and quit. But, you know, she drops a spoon into a pot of boiling water, she's stirring, she'll just reach in and grab it. At school, they put ice cubes in her chili, else she'd just drink it scalding hot. Every day after lunch recess, she goes to the school nurse. The school nurse does a head-to-toe inspection. Have you gotten hurt today? You have no idea of the gift of pain. These people worry constantly about things like appendicitis. You'd have no idea until it ruptured and you'd die of sepsis. You'd have no clue. They're constantly checking themselves, have I gotten hurt? Anytime they come in from outside, they, you know, have hands, you know, feet, face, the works. Those of you that want to feel no pain, I have patients like that. And after I give them that pain scale, 0 to 10, well, it's a 5. I say, what would you like that to be? And they kind of look at me, well, 0. I said, I can give you a 0. That's ICU, intubated, sedated, paralyzed, the works. I can get you 0 pain. We call that anesthesia. It's a little expensive, but it can be done. These people have anesthesia 24/7. You have no clue of the gift of pain. This guy I read about in school, I tried finding the story and was unsuccessful. They actually built him a set of gloves with pressure sensors. So when he'd use a screwdriver and reef on it too hard, well, we think that's all the harder I can go. You have lots more strength to go. It's the pain that actually tells your brain to stop. Well, he found this annoying. It had a beeper or buzzer or shocker or something on it. He found it annoying. So he would turn it off, do the job he wanted to do, and then turn the system back on. Which, if you had the ability to turn off pain, you would do too. And that's why God, for the vast majority of the population, has not given us that option. Pause and think about all the times you feel pain, that you need to feel pain. You're in a car wreck. No, I'm fine. Your femur's in pieces, sir. Your foot is over there. You are not fine. Oh, I didn't feel it. Ashlyn Blocker's mom said this, and I'll close. Pain is there for a reason. It lets your body know something's wrong and it needs to be fixed. Get this. I'd give anything for her to feel pain. As a father, I recently had my daughter in the emergency room. She fell and poked the corner of a wooden drawer right into the corner of her eye socket. And 6 hours and stitches and ketamine later, we were home again. And she's laying there, you know, screaming until they finally got her sedated so they could sew her back up. And as a father, I say, give me the pain. This is not right. I would happily take her pain. I'm really glad she has pain. I'm really glad she has pain. But the fact is, the day is coming where we'll all have SCN 9A. Revelation, God's going to take away pain. There's going to be no more pain. We won't have to worry about burning ourselves on hot mufflers. There's going to be no more pain. I invite you to wonder in the marvelous works of God.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.